Hey everyone, and welcome to your weekly Linux and open source news podcast. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a show where I discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web spaces. So, this week, we've got Fedora going all in on AI, or at least announcing a plan to try and do just that. We also have the release of Ubuntu 24.04 beta. We also have a server vulnerability that will be left unfixed on a lot of manufacturers' hardware. We have explicit sync coming to fix the final remaining issues with NVIDIA on Wayland. We have Proton expanding their library of tools by buying standard nodes. We've got some cool updates to most big desktop environments, including GNOME and KDE, but also smaller ones like Elementary OS and LXQt. And we also have some good gaming news about Wayland Gaming, but some bad gaming news for League of Legends players. So, as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links that I used are in the show notes of this episode. And if you want to keep this show going, it is only fan-funding supported, so I also left links in the description of the podcast to help support this show. And if you become a Patreon member, you will also get access to a daily version of that show from Monday to Friday, so you don't have to wait for the end of the week to get all that juicy information. So, now let's get started. So, let's begin with Fedora. Matthew Miller, the lead for the Fedora project, wrote a blog post about the strategy for Fedora going into the future, soberly named Fedora Strategy 2028. So, I would assume it is a four-year plan. The first thing will be to reorganize the various work groups that they recently created to get into a more legible structure so new people coming to Fedora will know better where they should go to help and contribute on the topic that they would like to contribute to. But the biggest info isn't really all of that. It is that Fedora is apparently willing to go all in on AI. Matthew thinks that AI will be just an accelerator and a tool, and that it will not really replace people, it will not really turn developers into prompt engineers, it will not destroy creativity or artists. He just thinks that it's going to be a tool once the dust settles, because right now it's just pure hype and no one is really thinking about the consequences. But he thinks that those consequences will not really materialize. He also thinks that general artificial intelligence and the Skynet thing is completely overblown, which I would agree with him on that. He also says that Linux needs to get in on AI if we don't want to be left behind by other operating systems. This is a point I already made in a previous show, that I might not be a fan of AI-related tools, but once every user of every other OS is used to have these assistants in their systems, moving to something that doesn't have them will be basically impossible. So yes, we do need some implementations of those kinds of tools. Now, Matthew has a few examples here, like for example, speech synthesis that has always been really bad on Linux, but could now be ultra-realistic and actually really useful as an accessibility tool. Or just translating open source projects in more languages would be way faster with AI. He also says that right now, all of this AI work is mostly proprietary. It is trained on hidden data. You don't really know what they use to train their models. It is running on hardware that doesn't necessarily have open source drivers by companies that just don't really care about open source at all. And I am someone really skeptical about AI, and I'm really skeptical about the current balance between the good that these tools can bring, because they definitely have some really cool use cases, versus the harm that these tools will undeniably create in society, for people's jobs, and for the general state of the web. So I was pretty dismayed by this blog post, because I love Fedora, I'm not a fan of AI, I'm not sure I want a distro to try and be the best for AI, because it just feels like marketing hype. I was a bit dismayed by this post, until I reached the point where Matthew pointed out that they do need to work with the rest of the open source world to define which AI tools that currently exist align with their values, meaning Fedora's values, but also generally Linux's values and the open source community's values. So they would like to implement policies to allow or deny certain tools depending on how they are trained, on how open the model is, and other things like that. He also says that they could deploy models directly in the OS itself to run purely locally, and so it just wouldn't send anything to any company or sell your personal data, all the prompts that you would pass to your own, let's say, ChatGPT equivalent on Fedora would not be sent to anyone. They would just run locally and they could update the model and its knowledge base and its results just by shipping packages, I guess, for Fedora. So, okay, if Fedora and the open source community or the Linux community can manage to find or to build models that first are not trained on data pilfered from the internet, because yes, this data was probably made public on a lot of websites, but being published on a public website doesn't mean that the data is free to be used however you want. You can view an image on Getty Images, doesn't mean you have the rights to download it and use it for any purpose. Same goes for any open source code, there's licenses attached to that. Same goes for any video online, for any blog post, any text, any article. They are all licensed under a specific license. Just because you can view them publicly doesn't mean you can do whatever you want with them. So if we can find a model that doesn't just use anything that's public, completely disregarding the licenses, that would be nice. Second, if they can make sure that these models are not privacy invasive at all, these AI tools just don't send your prompts to a big tech company or don't share the data of your usage, if we're not just the usual crapware that saves you 10 seconds of typing in exchange for completely invading every single part of your personal life, then sure, let's go for it. It kind of reminds me of what Nextcloud is currently doing. They do let you install access and plugins to various AI tools. You can even just install those AI tools and models directly on your server and plug them in with your Nextcloud instance. But they do rate all of these AI tools to try and show you which ones would be considered ethical or not ethical, which ones are more open source, which ones aren't, so you can make an informed decision. If Fedora can do the same kind of stuff and the Linux community as a whole just collaborates on this kind of stuff, it would be nice, it would be the right way to implement this, but I just hope that they don't go into the rat race, just trying to run after ChatGPT, after what Microsoft is doing, Google's Bard, Meta's Llama, whatever. They just don't want to do that. You need to implement this in a reasoned fashion, not the fastest possible, but the best way possible. It is probably necessary to give people access to those AI tools if we want to make sure Linux stays relevant on the desktop, but it also needs to be done in a respectful way for everyone who already uses Linux and has specific ethical values. Now, this week we also saw the beta release for Ubuntu 24.04 LTS. As planned, it was delayed 1 week. It was initially planned for the previous week, but it was released on this one because they wanted to check that the vulnerability and the backdoor in the XZ library had not affected any other package that might have depended on the XZ library. So they pushed it back 1 week. 24.04 will be a long-term support release, meaning you get 5 years of official support for most packages and the OS itself. If you have an Ubuntu Pro subscription, you can push that to 10 years. And with like the extended Ubuntu Pro, whatever thing, legacy support thingy, you can push that 2 more years. So 12 years of support in total. But you also can expect a bunch of improvements, whether you're a 22.04 LTS user or you're a 23.10 user. First, you get GNOME 46. It's not the biggest GNOME release ever. I have a dedicated video on my channel to cover it. Go check that out if you want to know more about what it brings. The gist of it is you get experimental variable refresh rate support. You get better fractional scaling, especially for how fonts look. You get improved Wayland support. You get a much improved file manager in Nautilus. You get collapsible and expandable notifications, you get reorganized settings, and the ability to log into a GNOME session through RDP without already being logged in into a session on that exact computer. On top of that, Ubuntu's installer got a bit of a redesign on most of its screens, and it does look a lot better than the first iteration of that installer that saw the light of day, I think it was a year ago. Plus, it also now supports automated deployments. You can create a .yaml config file and you can just automate deployments on multiple computers, something that was missing from the installer. The default app selection changed just a little bit. They replaced Cheese by Snapshot to handle the webcam that you might have on your laptop or plugged into your desktop. They completely ditched the GNOME Games package from the install. You can still reinstall it manually, but no amount of extended or complete install will now install games by default, which I think is fine. And Thunderbird has been moved to a Snap package instead of being a Deb package. This Snap is officially supported by the Thunderbird team now, just like they officially support the Flatpak package, so I guess it's not a transition for the worst, because it should be in a good state. But if you hate Snaps, that's still one dent, but I guess if you hate Snaps, you're probably not using Ubuntu in the first place. You will also get the kernel 6.8, so the latest available right now, and it also brings some power efficiency improvements, because they will use brand new power profiles that are being mapped to the power profiles you can pick in the graphical user interface. For example, if you pick the performance profile or the battery safe profile, under the hood, they are mapped to brand new power profiles that take advantage of the new Intel and AMD P-State drivers, which will definitely deliver better battery life than the previous modes. You will also get a better gaming experience, because Ubuntu increased the virtual memory mapping limit to the same amount as what stuff like Fedora uses, but also now Arch. They did the exact same change recently, meaning that some games that completely crashed and didn't open, or some games that tended to crash or have very degraded performance after a while, will now run much better. So it looks like an interesting release, nothing groundbreaking, but it's an LTS, so they're not gonna break the whole desktop just for fun. But it looks good, so I will obviously have a dedicated video on the channel when it releases. I think it's on the 25th of April. So if you're not subscribed to the YouTube channel, The Linux Experiment, go do that. And if you are, well, I guess you will just receive that video in your subscription feed, like always. Now, we do need to talk about security and vulnerabilities again after the problem with the .exe library, because a lot of people will now be stuck with vulnerable hardware that will simply not be fixed, because there is a vulnerability in Lite TPD. It's an old vulnerability that has been fixed for a while, but is now coming to light. Lite TPD is a lightweight HTTP server that is embarked on small computers that are added to the motherboards for servers to help with remote management. Those are called BMCs, and they let sysadmins reinstall operating systems, they can install and uninstall applications on their servers, and they can generally just control those servers even when they're off, because they have an additional computer that's based on a lightweight HTTP server that lets them transmit commands to the server itself. The issue here is that Lite TPD issued a fix in 2018 for a big fat vulnerability. They didn't call it that, they didn't create CVEs or whatever, but they did issue a fix. The problem is that fix was never really deployed to a bunch of servers from Intel, Lenovo, Supermicro, but also from motherboard manufacturers like AMI or AETN. These manufacturers even continued to ship the old version that is vulnerable of Lite TPD on relatively recent hardware, and they have apparently zero plans to issue fixes to that affected hardware, apart from Supermicro, who still supports some of these affected products. Now, none of the third-party suppliers that provided Intel and Lenovo and Supermicro with those BMCs, those little extra computers on their server motherboards, none of those suppliers bothered to update their stuff. So the flaw affects a bunch of servers in the wild. And this flaw has no hope of being fixed, meaning that customers now have to either disable the BMC, thus losing access to a pretty valuable feature to control your servers remotely, a feature they paid for when they bought that server, or they will have to buy brand new hardware to avoid getting hacked through a very public flaw that lets attackers send malicious HTTP requests to this little extra computer, which then lets them read the memory of the Lite TPD server, they can exfiltrate data, and they can bypass other security mechanisms, or just grab enough data for a social engineering attack, or stuff like that. This vulnerability is only ranked at moderate severity, because it gives you access to the small BMC, not to the entire server. It won't let attackers take complete control of a server by itself, but it could still help attackers implement a bigger attack on the server by analyzing which commands have been passed and identifying which other parts of the server might be vulnerable. Not having any fix in sight for this thing is really pretty bad. Now we need to talk about Wayland and specifically Nvidia on Wayland, because we are seeing probably the last big issue being fixed right now. This all comes from a nice blog post from Xavier Hugel. He's a KDE team member, and he explains what explicit sync is and why this is going to fix the problems with Nvidia on Wayland. The gist of it is that explicit sync is a method that lets the application you're running tell the drivers, the kernel, the compositor, basically the entire graphic stack that renders that application on screen. It tells that stack when it has finished rendering its next frame and when to synchronize that frame to the display, meaning that performance is better because the drivers don't have to do as much work. They don't have to pull every app and every display as much to see if they need to render something. It's just the app telling you, hey, I'm done, render me. And the compositor can just do that by taking advantage of the drivers, the kernel, and all that stack underneath. With explicit sync landing in the Wayland protocols, it means that Nvidia users are finally going to get as good an experience as users of any other GPU, because the Nvidia proprietary drivers never supported implicit sync on Wayland, which was the method that was used previously. They only support explicit sync. And this led to pretty bad issues for some Nvidia users on Wayland, notably some graphical glitches with applications just displaying broken stuff, with VSync and screen tearing issues, with frame pacing issues in games. It was a nightmare for some users. I personally never experienced that problem on any of my Nvidia GPUs, but judging from the comments on the internet, it is a widespread problem. And that exact problem will be gone once the proprietary drivers are updated and once all compositors implement this new protocol, and also once X-Wayland adds that support, which is going to be soon because the X-Wayland part is merged already. It's been submitted by Nvidia themselves, and the code apparently takes inspiration from the corresponding Wayland protocol, meaning it's going to be easier to support it. It's 11 patches, and Nvidia has been working on those since August 2022, so seeing that finally merged is pretty nice. Nvidia should probably have an updated driver soon to take advantage of that as well. The Mesa drivers can already implement that explicit sync protocol for Wayland. GNOME's compositor Mutter already supports it as well. And as far as I know, Kwin will support it too in Plasma 6.1, planned for June. So in June, probably every distro will have this update shipped. Every compositor will support it. Well, every major compositor will support it. The Nvidia drivers will be updated as well, meaning that technically, at worst, in June, Nvidia on Wayland and games played under X-Wayland will now be just as good as playing those games on AMD hardware or dedicated Intel GPUs. So everything is lining up pretty nicely. And if we still encounter problems with the Nvidia binary drivers, by the time June comes around, I'm pretty sure we will have access to NVK and Nuvo, and in the future we'll also have Nova, the new open source drivers for recent Nvidia GPUs. So graphics on Linux, even for Nvidia, are in a really good place right now. It's really cool to see. Now let's talk about Proton, as in the makers of Proton Mail and Proton VPN, not Proton the thing Valve made based on Wine to play some games. Proton acquired Standard Notes. It is a note-taking app that you might have heard about. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it in one of my videos about the best note-taking apps on Linux. It is open source, it is end-to-end encrypted, and presumably Proton wants to use it to bring Proton Notes to life as its own product in Proton's suite of online tools. They already have mail, calendar, contacts, VPN, online storage, and a password manager, but they did not have any way of taking solid notes with that. You could just create documents in your storage, but that's not as useful. So Standard Notes is now part of Proton's portfolio. Now, they did this in a good way because it will remain open source, obviously, and it will still undergo independent audits to check that their encryption is up to snuff. Their pricing will not change, so whether you're using the free tier or a paid tier of Standard Notes, you're not left behind, your price is not changing. And Standard Notes actually confirmed this. They said they would still operate as their own independent product, but they will benefit from Proton's resources to make the app better in the long run. The goal for Proton, by keeping that thing separate, is probably just to integrate Standard Notes into the Proton suite of tools as an optional module, probably by letting you use your Proton account to sync notes between devices or to connect to a Standard Notes account. Probably being a paid customer for Proton will also give you a Standard Notes subscription on top of that, which will be completely integrated. And maybe at some point they will develop a web-based interface to access your notes. I'm not sure Standard Notes has that right now. They have clients for virtually every OS, but I'm not sure if they have a web-based interface. Presumably Proton would develop that. Things like these seem logical and likely. That's what they did when they bought Simple Login. You can still access Simple Login as a product to create email addresses on the fly that are disposable, that you can link to, I don't know, a newsletter subscription or to create an account on a specific website. But they also integrated that natively inside of Proton Mail. I'm pretty sure they're going to do the same thing with Standard Notes. They're going to create something called Proton Notes that will download the Standard Notes client. You will be able to sync with it using your Proton Mail account. You will probably have access to storage and whatever linked to your Proton storage. I'm pretty sure that's what they're going to do. It seems like a good match because both companies do not rely on venture capital. They just grew organically by selling stuff to their clients, not by taking in external money to try and do the cheapest thing possible and hope that at some point they break even. They are both based in the open source world, and Notes is a feature that a lot of Proton users requested. So it makes sense to try and bring that product, and why not just buy something that respects the exact same values as you do and is widely regarded as a pretty solid solution instead of redeveloping yet another note solution that would probably just be marked down anyway as well. So I'm glad to see that. I do hope that the promises of every product being independent will be followed, but judging from Proton's past, I don't think there's anything to worry about here. Now let's talk about desktop environments, and we're going to start with KDE because there are some nice updates coming to Plasma 6.1. The first one being a streamlined way of setting key bindings and shortcuts, meaning that you will now be able to set the super key to do whatever you want, like opening the overview, opening KRunner, or anything else. Currently, in 5.27 or in Plasma 6.0, you have to use the command line to map the super key itself, just the super key, to a specific function. I had to do that on my own system to map it to opening KRunner on KDE 5.27. On 6.1, you will just be able to say super is a key like any other, that's a shortcut, I wanted to open the overview, and now my KDE desktop works just like it does in GNOME. So that's nice. You will also be able to sync your RGB lighting, if you have that, with your Plasma accent color. So if you have one of those gaudy, horrible, full of RGB gaming computers, you will be able to have all your lights follow the accent color of your desktop, which, why not? It's cool. Discover will also let you switch snap packages to be updated manually instead of automatically if you use that. And of course, you will get the explicit sync protocol support in KWin, the compositor, meaning that your Wayland and ex-Wayland experience might be a lot better in KDE 6.1 as well. It's pretty cool stuff. I still haven't got the Plasma 6 update on my main distro, Tuxedo OS, but I did enjoy it on Nobara, which is the OS I decided to install on my gaming console because HoloISO, the version I use, was not updated, and updating it to the new immutable version failed utterly and resulted in an unbootable system. So I moved to Nobara, I now have Plasma 6, and I can safely say there's not much difference between the two. It's nicer, but it's not super big. 6.1 should be a very nice update though, so can't wait to get access to that. Now, in GNOME land, we have the team working on using Nautilus as a provider for the file chooser portal. meaning that instead of opening a GTK file picker from Flatpak applications, you would actually open a Nautilus instance with all the features that you like on Nautilus, with all your places, bookmarks saved, and all the stuff like that. So that would be pretty cool, I guess, because Nautilus has progressed much faster than the regular basic GTK file picker. Printing support is also coming to WebKit GTK, meaning that Flatpak Epiphany could now print through the printing portal. There's more work on implementing encryption on the home directory through systemd homed, and there's also a lot more work on GNOME's online accounts to better support WebDAV, stuff for example used by Nextcloud, or to better support Microsoft 365. And we even have some mockups for an OS installer that could be used by any distro that decides to ship GNOME, which also would be cool because, well, you would get an installer that looks like the system that you're gonna use afterwards. Same goes for global shortcut support in GNOME. There are now mockups to describe how you would register these shortcuts, which are pretty crucial for certain applications under Wayland. For example, if you stream or record using OBS, having global keyboard shortcuts is pretty important to be able to start and stop recordings or to switch to various scenes during your stream. And since the global shortcuts portal is now implemented inside of GNOME, having an actual UI to manage that would be nice. It should land in GNOME 47. So that's good stuff coming. Like I said in my review of GNOME 46, the brunt of the work that was funded by the Sovereign Tech Fund didn't land in GNOME 46. It will land in 47 and probably 48 as well. So these two are probably going to be very, very big releases. Now, on the elementary OS front, it looks like they are making progress on Elementary OS 8, which is their next release, which will be based on Ubuntu 24.04. They landed the complete redesign of the system settings as they did the porting work to GTK 4. So it has a better dual pane design for certain settings pages and is now completely ported to GTK 4. App settings also gain the ability to tweak Flatpak permissions, and there are a bunch of improvements to various setting pages as well, including, for example, the ability to disable overlay scroll bars. As per the rest of the desktop, the brand new dock that they're creating to replace Plank, because Plank could not support Wayland, where their new dock will, it gained a bunch of features. First, you will be able to scroll on an app icon to switch between its open windows. You will also be able to middle click, so using the scroll wheel to click an app icon, it will open a new window for that app. The super key will now also open the menu by default instead of the shortcuts overlay, a change that is absolutely welcome because using that very important key alone to just open a shortcuts overlay never really made sense to me, in my opinion. I think it was UX thinking pushed too far. Like, what is a user going to do first? They're going to push the super key because that's what they're used to on Windows. So we should use the super key to show them all the keyboard shortcuts they could use because obviously they use the keyboard shortcut. They want to know more about keyboard shortcuts. But that's not the expected behavior of the super key. And it's very hard to unlearn that. So it's good that they moved that default behavior. For Wayland support, they also fixed notifications, they improved startup time, they fixed a few other issues, and it looks like the Wayland session should be pretty solid when OS 8 comes out. Now, as shown by the recent survey I made on my channel, Elementary OS is not a very popular distro or desktop, at least not amongst people who watch what I make, but it is still one of my favorites, personally. It looks great, it's always super polished, and I really enjoy that they're trying to do their own different thing. So I will obviously try it again when OS 8 releases, hopefully not too long after Ubuntu 24.04 comes out, and I will also probably have to resist switching to it because that's always the case when they release something new. I always have to force myself to not install that instead of what I'm currently using. Now, Linux Mint users can look forward to another pretty cool change. They're gonna get what Mint calls ultra-fast repositories to host their packages and to make sure users can install stuff and update their systems as fast as possible. It's a beta test for now, but they're moving to a CDN, or Content Distribution Network, meaning that all their packages will be distributed in a bunch of servers all around the world, and you automatically will be moving to the fastest one near you. This launched as a beta test. You can try it out if you're willing to change the URL in your apt sources to the new URL, namely fastly.linuxmint.io. And once that beta test is complete, if everything seems positive, if people don't encounter problems or access issues or speed issues, they will move everyone to those new repos automatically, and no one will have anything to do to benefit. I initially wasn't sure what the difference was with mirrors, because you also already have a bunch of mirrors located all around the world to download packages from Linux Mint. The thing is, a CDN will always be a bit more reliable than that, because it's already being used, it's a much bigger scale, it's not individually hosted package repos by either individuals or associations. It guarantees you basically a much better speed. It also works with load balancing, which those mirrors generally will not. So if a mirror is currently slower because the server is undertaking some maintenance, you will still try and download from that mirror because that's what listed in your sources. If you have access to the CDN instead, you will download from the faster server from that content distribution network. No matter if the closest one to you is undertaking maintenance, you will still download from the one that is fastest for you. So there are advantages, as have been pointed out to me in my daily Linux and open source news show. I asked people that question because I wasn't sure what was the advantage of that. So pretty cool. You will get way faster repos on Linux Mint. That's always nice. Now it's time for a little segment on privacy, and it looks like the recent set of EU laws, like the Digital Markets Act, had a real impact, at least in the web browser space, because smaller and independent browsers that don't belong to companies like Google, Apple, or Microsoft, these smaller browsers are seeing some growth. A browser I had never heard about, called Aloha, jumped 250% in terms of user numbers in the EU, now reaching 10 million monthly users. Vivaldi, DuckDuckGo, or Opera also reported some significant growth. On iPhones, at least, the process of selecting that default browser is criticized, because if you don't know, the Digital Markets Act forced iOS and Android to implement browser ballot screens to let you pick which default browser you want, which is why those smaller browsers are seeing some growth. But on iOS at least, this browser ballot screen is being criticized as being clunky, and the update that brings it is apparently slow to roll out to all EU countries, compared to how fast Apple generally pushes their updates to users. And it is judged a bit confusing, because they say that the choice screen to pick your default browser only appears if you open Safari. I did personally receive that screen, and I didn't even know it existed until I opened Safari. But that's because I personally already use another browser, which is Firefox on iOS. It's Safari in disguise, but it's still the Firefox app. I don't see this as a problem, because if you already use another browser, you don't need that browser ballot screen. And if you don't use another browser, the first time you get the update and you open Safari, you do get that screen. And it's nicely designed on iOS. You get a first screen explaining to you why you get that choice. Then you get a list of browsers. You click on one, it opens its App Store page where you can install it or open it if it's already installed, and it sets it as the default. I think it's completely adequate, and I really don't see why those smaller browsers are complaining, because it seems fine. Now, it is good to see that this set of regulations had an impact, because it proves that it's not just that people don't like other smaller browsers, it's that they tend to just use the default if you don't offer them a choice. And it also proves that they're at least willing to give something else a try if they get the option. Now, whether they will stick to the new browser they started using, that's an entirely different thing. But at least they're willing to try. So it doesn't mean that people prefer Safari on iOS or prefer Chrome on Android. It means that they just use that because that's what the OS provides, and that's it. And it also looks like, on the privacy front, that US citizens might be able to soon enjoy the same sort of privacy protections that EU citizens are currently benefiting from. Maybe even a little bit more protection than what the EU guarantees. Because there's a new bipartisan law proposal. It's called the American Privacy Rights Act. And it aims to place limits on what companies can ask from users in terms of data. And it will also let users opt out of being targeted by ads. They would also gain the right to view, to correct, to delete, and to download their own data from all of these services, and there would be a new national registry of data brokers being created, which would let users opt out of having their data sold altogether, presumably by telling this registry, hey, if you get any data containing my personal information, I'm Mr. or Mrs. X, just don't sell it, I do not give you permission to sell my data. In itself, this proposal even looks more comprehensive than what we have, at least in France, because as far as I know, in France, there's no real way to tell a company or a data broker that you do not agree to your data being sold. Once you accepted to share that data with someone, you can't specifically say you don't want it to be sold. Now, this new US law would also let individual states pass their own privacy laws on top of these federal protections or retain stronger protections than they already have. So this would be the baseline for privacy at a federal level in the US, and then states could just up the ante and bring more protections in place if they wanted. It is still just a draft for now, so any big lobby could swoop in, distribute a bunch of cash, and make that whole bill go away fast, because that's something we've seen in the US and, to be frank, in every other country or even in the EU. But it would be amazing to see it passed. It would make a pretty big dent in big tech companies' ability to siphon data and to sell it. Now, I personally depend on targeted ads to make a living, because most of my revenue comes from YouTube ads on my YouTube channel. If those ads get less efficient, I get less money, but still I think it would be a net positive for the internet if people had more control over their data and their privacy. Okay, and let's finish this episode on a gaming news little segment. So first, we're going to lose access to League of Legends soon. Personally, I couldn't care less. I think this game is extremely toxic. I hate PvP in any game. I think MOBAs are just really bad games and I just do not enjoy playing that kind of crap. But a lot of people really like League of Legends and will be very disappointed to see it go from Linux. Riot Games is implementing their Vanguard anti-cheat tool soon, and that tool doesn't support Linux. They addressed that exact issue in an FAQ. They said that they never officially supported Linux, and that the current use of Wine to run that game will just not work anymore because their Vanguard anti-cheat tool is a kernel-level tool. And they said that Linux doesn't give them enough ways to, and I quote, affect the boot state or the kernel modules, which I would say is a pretty positive thing that Linux doesn't let them do that, because no game or application should be able to affect the boot state of your computer or the modules loaded in the kernel. They should never have any way of reading, managing, or affecting that in any way. Now, Riot also said that there are too many differences between distros for them to even try and implement a solution. And as per Proton or Wine support, they said it would amount to leaving a backdoor open specifically for Linux, and that backdoor would be exploited by cheaters on other platforms. And as they said, they only have about 800 daily players that use Linux, and that's just not worth it for them to support. And I mean, yeah, that's the issue with kernel-level anti-cheat. Unless your OS is an absolute pushover and lets you do whatever you want to it, then of course they're never gonna work. And honestly, they should never be able to work. No operating system should have a mechanism for a game or an app to read, write, affect, or modify the boot process or the kernel of your system. An application's role is not to do that. They should not be able to do it. A driver? Sure. An application? No. Especially not a game that you play for leisure. So, Linux should not do anything to try and accommodate for that. If it means we lose access to some games, well, it sucks. But in the end, those anti-cheat tools, those kernel-level tools, are just not an acceptable thing to install on your computer. They're a security vulnerability and a privacy problem just waiting to happen. Now, we also have some good news for gaming on Wayland, at least if you use an AMD GPU, because Phoronix did a little benchmark comparing the performance under the AMD drivers between Wayland and X11 on GNOME and on Plasma 6. Now, first, their GNOME results can be dismissed out of hand, because they tested this on KDE Neon, they installed the GNOME version that is currently on KDE Neon, that's GNOME 42, it's 4 full versions older than the current one, so obviously the Wayland support and the performance has evolved a lot, so those results just cannot be used because they're not representative of the current state of GNOME. But the Wayland transition for gaming seems pretty much complete for Plasma on AMD. Performance under Plasma 6 and Wayland was nearly identical with performance under Plasma 6 and X11, meaning that even if it will be cool to get native Wayland support for Wine and Proton and thus not need X Wayland, it is not really needed at all for a good gaming experience when using Plasma on AMD. And I would expect the same to be true once Explicit Sync lands for Nvidia as well. Now, I would like to see Foronix do that with GNOME 46 as well, just to see if the same applies to the latest version of GNOME, or if it's just KDE being really good in their Wayland support and GNOME lagging behind a little bit. And obviously, once Explicit Sync lands, I would also love to see a comparison between the Wayland performance and the X11 performance. When I read this article, I actually did a little comparison on my own computer running an NVIDIA RTX 3060. On a laptop under Wayland and X11, and I noticed zero difference in Helldivers 2 and also in Total War Warhammer 3. The frame rates were absolutely identical whether I ran the game on X11 or I ran it on Wayland with X Wayland. So maybe that's because I didn't encounter the explicit sync issue, which I never encountered on my NVIDIA GPU, but it seems like it's already pretty good, at least for my own graphics card and distro and config. And finally, we also got a few more details about the Orange Pi Neo. That's the new Linux-powered handheld developed in partnership with Manjaro, which will be the OS used by this device. This little marketing video that they shared gave a few more details about the look and feel, the thickness of the device, and it does look pretty nice. It's based on a Ryzen 7 7840HS. It starts at $499, and for $599, you can upgrade that CPU to an 8840U. You will get, in both cases, a 50 watt-hour battery. You get Hall Effect joysticks with no dead zones that come with RGB lighting. You get a 7-inch 1920 by 1200 display that runs up to 120 Hz. You get a 6-axis gyro, and it comes in black or white. They didn't give a release date yet, and while the talk from Manjaro's CEO is kind of Apple-worthy in terms of marketing gimmicks and language, it does give a few more details on the Hall Effect linear triggers, on the construction of the device without any apparent screws on the outside of the case, meaning you can just pry the case open to modify or clean the thing. It also gives a few more details on the distro. It won't be regular old Manjaro, it will be Manjaro Gaming OS. It is an immutable distro using BetterFS, it distributes apps using Flatpak, and it uses Plasma 6 as the desktop mode, and obviously will come with a gamepad UI by default, because, well, you can't expect people to use joysticks to navigate KDE. Now, it is a relatively short video, it's 9 minutes long. If you like this kind of device or you have any interest in Linux-powered gaming handhelds, it's worth the watch just to see if this could be something you would like to buy or that you would enjoy gaming on. It does look like an interesting device. I'm not the biggest fan of Manjaro, but an immutable version of it might fix the reliability issues that I've always encountered when I tried using it, so maybe it's a good choice. Okay, so this will conclude this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, thank you all so much to people who support the show and the channel. They make this show possible. If you want to join them, you can also do so by clicking one of the links in the description of this episode, in the show notes. And if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, you can do so as well. I left all the links that I used to write this show in the show notes as well. So thanks for listening, and I guess you will hear me in the next one next week. Bye!